Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for March 7th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, punishing those who help you, tracking near-Earth objects, global sea level changes, and a new editor-in-chief takes over the reins of Science Magazine. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
The Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Antisocial punishment is punishing someone who helps you. Who would do that? Evidently, lots of people. In a paper in this week's Science, Simone Gaister and colleagues document widespread antisocial punishment across many societies, though the extent of antisocial punishment does vary. I spoke with Gaister from the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom.
We call it antisocial punishment because people punish those who behaved nicely to them. So you punish somebody who behaved nicely to you, and that's an antisocial thing, and this is why we call it antisocial punishment. It is a very puzzling and surprising finding, and one that we did not discover in the past that much. It only started when we started to run experiments in places outside our sort of Western cultures. People apparently didn't accept being punished if they failed to contribute to the public good. So then they kind of punish back. A sort of revengeful punishment is probably one of the sources of this antisocial punishment. And that's certainly one motivation. Another motivation is probably that people don't like do-gooders. Another reason is that people don't like those who are too generous. People might interpret it as showing off. It's a phenomenon that needs explaining, and we have now recorded that it exists and that it can be very, very important and substantial. And of course, it's a factor that inhibits cooperation very much.
What are some of the real-world situations, these cooperative situations that this research might apply to?
Yeah, some real-world situations concern teamwork, environmental concerns, behavior and organizations, neighborhood watch, all sorts of social interactions where basically the group benefits from each other's actions, but everybody benefits from selfish free riding. So climate change is probably the cooperation problem on the grandest scale that humanity faces, but the same sort of logic and problem exists in smaller scales in many, many, many situations.
What might explain these different levels of antisocial punishments across these different cultural groups?
I think that's a very good question for future research to answer. I mean, what we have seen is that this variation that you observe is strongly linked to some societal things like the strength of civic norms in the society, so civic norms of cooperation that people have measured. So other social scientists have measured what people think, how important, how justified tax evasion is, for instance, or free riding on public transport, or abusing the welfare state. In some societies, people think it's totally unjustified, whereas in others, people think, well, it's okay a little bit or something. So this is when societies are called weak, to have weak civic norms of cooperation. And antisocial punishment, for instance, occurs in particular in those societies with weak social norms of cooperation. Or another societal factor is the rule of law. So how in a country, this is an indicator developed by the World Bank, and this measures how well the law enforcement institutions work in a society, so how impartial the law enforcement works and how fair it is and these sort of things. And again, we observe that in those societies in which the law enforcement works well, so which means the rule of law is good and strong, we don't get antisocial punishment. This is in societies with weak rules of law. Or there are several other factors that correlate with this. What this suggests is that the punishment that you observe somehow reflects the wider societal background. What exactly are the approximate mechanisms that lead people to punish antisocially is something the research now has to address because it's apparently a very important phenomenon to understand.
Simone Gaister is senior author of a paper on antisocial punishment across societies. Read the paper in this week's Science.
I am at heart a scientist, and scientists love to tackle important challenges.
Bruce Alberts is the new editor-in-chief of Science Magazine.
As editor-in-chief of Science, the challenge will be to continue to improve this journal, which has long been a major vehicle for spreading scientific findings, as well as for promoting the community standards essential for the success of the scientific enterprise. Why did I accept this position? In many ways, I see it as an extension of my 12 years as president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, which publishes more than 200 reports every year. In that position, I became painfully aware of the many missed opportunities to spread science and scientific ways of thinking. I also became aware that science is a remarkable social construct which relies on constant vigilance to maintain the standards that make it so successful. As a social construct, it matters a great deal how we scientists treat our colleagues, how we reward excellence, how we share our data and resources, and how we relate to the public whose taxes support the scientific enterprise with generous research funding. And Science Magazine plays an important part in protecting these kinds of cultural values. How? It does so through the way that it selects the articles it publishes, enforces standards of honesty and data sharing, and makes all scientific articles freely available on the web within a year of publication. Equally important, Science Magazine produces a vigorous news section that, with honesty and integrity, attempts to probe every aspect of science and its interface with society. My predecessor as editor-in-chief, Donald Kennedy, has done a masterful job in tackling the challenges of this position. He wrote over 150 editorials, boldly defending the scientific point of view on everything from genetically modified crops to climate change. He has shown strong support for young scientists through the Science Careers website that he promoted, and he has repeatedly insisted on the highest standards of scientific conduct. Donald Kennedy has set a nearly impossible standard to follow, and I salute his past achievements. Now the challenge for me and for Science Magazine's outstanding staff is to try to make this publication an even more effective agent for spreading science and its values throughout the world. How we perform will be critical because our increasingly crowded world will need new science and the values to conduct our scientific enterprise meaningfully and responsibly. I'm Bruce Alberts.
Bruce Alberts is Science Magazine's new editor-in-chief. You can read the full version of his editorial in this week's Science. Near-Earth objects, or NEOs, are comets and asteroids that have orbits that either cross Earth's path or come into Earth's neighborhood. Some of them are large enough to cause catastrophic damage were they to strike Earth. Over the next several years, new telescopes will come online to detect and track NEOs, and scientists expect to spot many thousands more NEOs than they already are tracking. In this week's Science, news writer Richard Stone reports on the tracking of NEOs and how unprepared we are to defend ourselves against them.
I was originally interested in the 100th anniversary of the Tunguska fireball. This was a meteorite, most people think, that exploded over the Siberian forest in June 1908. And I wanted to find out about that. And the more I looked into the issue of asteroid impacts and the potential threat to Earth, the more fascinating the story got. NASA has been sponsoring efforts to find, detect near-Earth objects called NEOs. And this effort started about 10 years ago. And that effort has been making really good progress. They've identified around 70% of the 1,000 or so asteroids over 1 kilometer in diameter. The planet killers, the catastrophe type of objects out there. Now, what's currently happening is they're pushing the search down to smaller rocks, but rocks that can devastate regions or states. And this is where it's getting really interesting because there are thousands of these objects out there. And they're detecting them very frequently now, and they're going to detect a whole bunch more in the next few years when some major new facilities come online.
Still, though, I mean, if the last really big one struck 65 million years ago and the last one we had that was of a good size was 100 years ago, I imagine the odds of one of these NEOs or near-Earth objects or asteroids hitting Earth are still pretty astronomical.
Well, it's a lot better odds than winning the Powerball lottery. I can assure you of that. There is just a statistical chance of Earth being struck by objects, asteroids of various sizes. But looking back on history, you can anticipate that an asteroid or a comet of the size that wiped out the dinosaurs strikes Earth every 100 million years or so. Or so, that's the key thing. Are we due? Who knows? What we know now is that it's very unlikely in the next century that an object of that size is going to hit Earth, because the ones that are being tracked are not on a collision course in the next century. But there are objects we don't know of, and there are comets that can just come in from the Oort cloud, and really little notice, we might be able to spot them a couple months away. And if they're on a collision course for Earth, there's almost nothing we can do about that.
Well, what then are the options for dealing with one of these near-Earth objects, comets or asteroids, in case they do happen to cross Earth's path at a time when we're there?
There are several options. If it's not on a direct collision course, if it might pass through what's known as a keyhole, a corridor of space that could bring it on a collision course on the next pass to Earth, if it's on course for a keyhole, it wouldn't take much to nudge it outside this very narrow corridor. So you might be able to use what's called a gravity tractor, a spacecraft that could hover in front or behind the asteroid, and in doing so, change its speed. And by changing its speed, you change the time that it will arrive passing in front of Earth or behind Earth. That's one option.
And I imagine there are other more dramatic ways of dealing with the near-Earth objects if they're bigger.
Or if they're on a direct collision course, and then the gravity tractor might not work. Maybe you have to use what's called a kinetic impactor, ramming the object with a missile or a spacecraft. That may provide enough oomph to get it off a collision course. That could be for a Tunguska-sized object or something on the order of a couple hundred meters wide. For the really big rocks, like 1 kilometer or so in diameter, this option might not work. You may be stuck with the nuclear option, using one or more nuclear devices to try to push these mega asteroids off course.
Or potentially cause a whole lot more of them as the big asteroid breaks apart from the explosion.
That's right, but if it's your only option.
So it sounds like early detection means the most peace of mind. How are near-Earth objects currently detected?
Well, currently there are several telescope facilities that NASA in particular is sponsored, but many space watchers throughout the world are tracking asteroids, discovering asteroids. Now, what's going to come online are a couple facilities that are going to just detect thousands of NEOs. There's a facility in Hawaii called Pan-STARRS, which will start coming up to speed on this in the summertime. It'll start its NEO detection. And there's another massive telescope project called the LSST that is likely to start up in 2014. So we're going to be detecting many thousands of NEOs, and that's going to raise a big question. We're going to see some that might be on a collision course or might possibly enter a keyhole. What do we do about it then?
Now, all this detection and the diversion, presumably someday, will cost money. Where's the money coming from?
Nobody knows where the money's going to come from, actually. The governments are predominantly funding the survey work. Some private investors are getting involved to help build portions of these new telescopes. But there is a problem, and that's if a threatening object is detected, there's no agency, no body that's going to tackle this problem. There's no money that's set aside for dealing with this issue. Leaders are going to have to confront this and perhaps act really quickly to take on this new challenge, this threat.
Science News writer Richard Stone on an article about near-Earth objects, including the asteroid Apophis, which could be a test case for how governments will deal with a potential asteroid impact on Earth in 2036. You can read his article in this week's Science. If the ocean gets deeper or wider, sea levels fall. Shallower and narrower, sea levels rise. In a paper in this week's Science, Dietmar Müller and colleagues show how ocean basin dynamics have driven sea level changes over the last 140 million years. This new model for global sea level change will help scientists understand natural causes of sea level change, as well as how human activity impacts global sea levels. I spoke with Müller from his office at the University of Sydney in Australia.
Understanding long-term sea level change over millions or tens of millions of years is one of the holy grails of geology. And so the topic of this paper is to quantify all the driving forces of long-term sea level change. So they include the aging and the deepening of the ocean basins through time, but also sedimentation, the emplacement of oceanic plateaus, and on top of that, the change in the oceanic area through time. Because as it turns out, that when a supercontinent, as it existed about 200 million years ago, Pangaea, slowly dispersed and disaggregated into all the continents as we know them today, the continental crustal area increased and the oceans shrunk. So we have considered all these effects for the first time to reconstruct the changing volume of the ocean basins.
Why is this just for the first time? Is it because of the data that is now available, or is there some new theory here?
No, it's because this is an enormous undertaking. So it's taken our research group about 10 years, including two postdoctoral researchers who've worked with me over the years and several students, to painstakingly reconstruct the continents and ocean basins through time. So we have to go around region by region and synthesize all the available information, geological and geophysical data, mapping the gravity and magnetic field of the ocean basins. And not only that, but we have to consider that because plate tectonics operates, oceanic crust is subducted all the time. So if you want to reconstruct the ocean basins back through time, you actually have to unsubduct the ocean floor that has over time been injected back into the mantle. And in a way, that means that we have to create synthetic plates. We have to make a model of what the ocean floor might have looked like that today no longer exists because it has been shoved back into the deep churning earth.
Why is it so important to have a good model of the sea level over the last 140 million years?
Okay, because we humans are very focused on the human impact on the Earth, on environmental change, climate change, including sea level rise. But what is often overlooked in this debate is that there are natural causes of sea level change. And of course, we need to understand these natural causes of longer-term sea level fluctuations in order to properly evaluate human-induced change that's added to this background fluctuation, if you like.
Are you able to extend your model out into the future? And if so, what does it show?
So that's an interesting question, because our model shows that sea level has gradually fallen over the last 80 million years. And this is an effect entirely independent of the waxing and waning of ice sheets. So this is entirely driven by an increase in the volume of the ocean basins, mostly due to the aging and deepening of the young ocean basins that formed when the supercontinent Pangaea that existed 200 million years ago gradually fell apart and dispersed. Right? And our model clearly shows that this effect will continue in the future. So for example, in the last million year, our model has a sea level fall of 2 meters. Now, that doesn't seem like much, right? But we would predict that, say, if we would wind forward by 50 million years and look into the future that far, then sea level would probably fall by several tens of meters based on this volume of the ocean basins effect. So what this means, if we humans still exist in 10, 20, or 50 million years, right, then irrespective of how ice caps will be waxing and waning, and irrespective of how climate at the surface of the Earth will change, the long-term sea level signal tells us that sea level will in fact drop, not rise.
But there still could be short-term periods.
Of course, in the short term, sea level will most definitely rise because the global warming driven by human-induced increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will, without any doubt, result in the further melting of inland ice sheets. And so in the short term, sea level will rise to some extent. However, in the longer term, over millions of years, our models tell us that there will be an element of sea level fall in this equation because the ocean basins will further age and deepen. The Atlantic Ocean will grow through time, the Pacific will shrink. More shallow and hot mid-ocean ridges will be subducted under the continents. They will disappear. And so we'll have more and more abyssal plains and less shallow mid-ocean ridges. And so this effect will make sea level drop further in the future.
Dietmar Müller is lead author of a paper on long-term sea level fluctuations driven by ocean basin dynamics. You can read the paper in this week's Science. Finally today, David Graham, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about new clues to a disease that turns young children effectively into senior citizens, how weeds evolve in the city, and finally, keeping track of alien invaders in Hawaii.
So these are kids that are getting too old too fast?
Right. This is a disease called progeria, and it's extremely rare. There's only a handful of kids in the entire world that are known to have this. But essentially what this does is it makes these kids resemble old people. Their bones give out very fast. They develop heart disease very early, and they often die in their teens because of this. And they're often bald and wrinkled and resemble older people overall. And it's a very mysterious disease. Scientists don't know a whole lot about what causes it. All they really know is that it appears to be tied to a protein called progerin, which is actually a defective form of a protein that's involved in stabilizing the nucleus. And so when these cells of these kids express progerin, the nucleus appears less stable. There seems to be problems with the DNA, but it's all very vague. They don't really know a whole lot about what's going on a molecular level.
So what these researchers do?
So what they did is they took normal skin cells and they made them express large amounts of progerin to see what effect it would have on the gene activity in the cell.
How many genes?
It was over 1,000 genes. And what was really interesting is a lot of these genes are involved in a pathway in the cell known as the Notch pathway. And Notch controls the differentiation of stem cells. It helps the cells decide, do I want to become a blood vessel cell or a bone cell or a fat cell? And that's significant because in these kids, a lot of their cells aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. For example, these kids are missing a layer of fat beneath their skin, giving them very thin skin. And the researchers found when stem cells are expressing progerin, they're less likely to turn into these fat cells. So this whole idea that it's not just progerin, but it's progerin's effect on stem cells really seems to be adding a lot of clues into what's going on a molecular level in this disease.
Is it possible that this same mechanism is behind our own aging process?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Rob. And in fact, when the researchers looked even at normal cells, they found that even normal cells express small amounts of progerin, which may explain how aging occurs in the rest of us.
Well, from growing too old too fast to something we wish wouldn't grow at all, weeds in cities.
Right, Rob. And this story has to do with a particular type of weed known as Crepis sancta, if I'm saying that right. And this weed produces two different types of seeds. It produces heavy seeds that basically fall straight down and take root where they fall, and lighter seeds that blow on the wind and disperse much farther from the parent plant. And in the wild, it might make sense to have both strategies. You might want to have some seeds grow close to you if you're growing in fertile ground and maybe disperse further if you think the ground is going to be fertile elsewhere. But the problem occurs when you have what's called patchy habitats. Imagine one of these weeds growing on an island. In that case, it makes a lot more sense for the plant to drop its seeds straight down, because if it makes the lighter seeds, they're going to float out into the ocean and not become plants.
Same thing then true for cities.
Right. Same thing would be true for cities. In a lot of cities, these weeds grow in these small patches of grass surrounded by lots of concrete. So if they make the heavy seeds is going to blossom into a plant, perhaps right where the grass is. But if it creates these airy seeds,
it flows into an ocean of concrete.
Exactly. So researchers wanted to test this hypothesis. And actually, in their own backyard in a city in France, sidewalks had just been built about 12 years ago, and the researchers said, hey, these weeds exist in our city. Did they somehow adapt to all this concrete? So what they did is they took some of these weeds from the city and compared them to the same weeds that grow in the country. And sure enough, the weeds that grew in the city produced a larger proportion of heavy seeds than the weeds that grew in the country, which makes sense, like I said before, because they don't want to waste a lot of energy producing seeds that are just going to fall on concrete.
So in 12 years, this change happened that fast?
Right. That was the really interesting thing. When the researchers did genetic analysis, they found out that this adaptation happened very quickly. Almost as soon as the sidewalks were put in, these plants started changing their habits about which type of seeds they would produce, meaning that this type of evolution can occur very quickly.
Is it likely you'd see that kind of speedy evolution in more natural systems?
Well, that's an open question. Obviously, the city is not a very natural environment, so researchers still have to test whether something could happen so rapidly in nature. But at least it shows that this type of evolution can happen very quickly.
Well, from how fast weeds take to cities to an alien species taking over Hawaii, what's going on there?
Right, Rob. Well, I teased you a little bit in the introduction. The aliens here are actually invasive species. And the reason they're a problem in Hawaii is because Hawaii is such a warm and fertile island chain that every time a new species is brought in, which happens very frequently from tourists, even from natives bringing new species over from the mainland, it tends to adapt very well to Hawaii. And that's a big problem for the native species on the island because they really haven't had time to adapt to these other species. So they end up suffering when these new species are brought in.
Not used to the competition.
Not used to the competition. But it's been really hard to quantify exactly how much damage these invasive species are doing, especially when we're talking about invasive plants and trees. The problem is that Hawaii is so lush, especially the mountains are so lush and impenetrable, it's hard for researchers to do these studies on foot. And even by satellite, there's so much vegetation that it's really hard to pick out one species from another and figure out what's going on.
So what did these researchers do? Invent some new technology?
Pretty much. Well, they invented what they call a hybrid technology. So they combine radar, which helps them peer through the canopy of the vegetation in Hawaii to really differentiate some of these plants and peer right straight into the heart of these forests. And they combined it with spectrographic analysis. And what this analysis allowed them to do was actually identify different plant species based solely on how their leaves reflect light. So not only could they see into the forest, but they could actually tell which plants they were looking at. So it gave them a much clearer view of what was going on these islands than anybody had had before.
So what did they find?
They found a lot of surprising and unfortunate things, a lot of invasion, and particularly things like the strawberry guava, which is an invasive species. This is a plant that grows up to 15 meters tall. And because of that, it dramatically alters the nutrient balance of the forest. It even, because it's so tall, restricts light from reaching the forest floor, which impacts a lot of species that don't grow as tall. And there's other species like something called the kahili ginger, which has roots that are so tough when they grow in the soil that other plants can't even penetrate.
So did they have to fly this instrument all over the island in order to get this data?
Yeah, they did. And the neat thing is that because the technology works so well, they may be able to apply it to other places besides Hawaii where there's dense vegetation to monitor invasive species and other things.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on Science Now?
Well, we're looking into a story about researchers getting closer to reading your mind, how moths remember their days as caterpillars, and finally, why so-called hobbits found in Indonesia may not be all they're cracked up to be.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check up on the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the Science Podcast for March 7th, 2008. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.